Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John. Obviously, of the two of us, I'm your host, Big John. And today, someone that I've been trying to connect with for a very long time, I'd say for about 6-7 years, and It just hasn't had the opportunity to happen until just now, but I'm very happy to have my guest. Let me look down at my notes so I get the proper introduction here. For this episode of The Big Questions with Big John, we dive into the vibrant world of Chrissy Mayer, a New York comedian and podcaster whose sharp humor lights up both stages and the podcast airwaves. From her stand-up on America's Got Talent and Fox various shows to hosting the Chrissy Mayer podcast and formerly The Wet Spot, Chrissy's journey is a blend of comedy, controversy, and charisma. Join me as we welcome her to the show. Everyone, please welcome Chrissy Mayer. Chrissy,
Yay!
How are you doing today?
Hi, Yay. Big John. I'm so curious how you got the nickname Big John. Is it a sexual nickname, or did something happen?
Much to the dismay of my wife, it has nothing to do with my sexual prowess. Ironically, it was a name given to me when I had my show at Sirius XM, and I was in a studio adjacent to some shared friend of ours, Sam Roberts. Eric Nagel and Dave McDonald at the time, they were doing their show, and they would see me lumbering up and down the halls to my studio. So one day they invited me on their show, and they said, "We've got Big Fat John here from the Sports Channel."
Oh, wow.
And it kind of stuck. I just edited out the fat part.
Yes, but yeah, it just came from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody always had to be the fat guy in any given room, and I guess when I showed up, it gave Eric a break from being that guy.
Yeah.
So that's how I got it. But anyway, great to have you on board. I always enjoy people that I admire, and I have to tell you, as a big a fan as comedy as I am, as much as I've dabbled in writing and whatnot, I have never had the courage to get up on stage and try my hand at stand-up. And I always have great admiration for any stand-up. I couldn't care less if people think they suck or they're wonderful. Anyone who has the ability to get on stage and attempt to entertain people, I find that to be inspiring and courageous. So let me ask you this. How did all this start? What was your childhood like? From what I get, you're a New Yorker like myself. You grew up on Long Island, is that right?
Yes. Yep, Rockville Center, the restaurant capital of Long Island, Nassau County. And, oh my gosh, childhood. How far do we want to go back? Let's see. I guess I was always like a sort of like funny kid, like getting, I don't know, not really getting into trouble, just sort of like irritating my family. Like I remember when I was very little, we'd be in church and I was raised Methodist, and they would always have these like prayer papers at the end of the pew, and you're supposed to write down like names of people to pray for. But instead, I would draw photos of our female pastor jumping off the roof of the church. I don't know why. I would just pass it down to my grandma. She'd be like, "What are you doing?" And then she would just throw more goldfish at me. She'd be like, "Here, eat this. Shut up." So, I remember that. I remember just being in like a church play as like one of the sheep, and my cotton balls were falling off. I don't know. And then I remember like I liked to be on stage. I would do these like puppet shows for like the church. I just would like, I remember I had, I don't know how young I was. I don't know. Definitely maybe 4. Who knows? I put a paper bag on my hand. I'd call it Danny the Donkey, and I would just be like talking to it. And that, I guess, evolved into, then I was like really into sports. I, from basically like 11 to all throughout college, I was a springboard diver. I went to a Division I school. So that focus of athletics like really helped me gave me a foundation of discipline and stick-to-itiveness, and it really set me up for my whole life not being somebody who gives up easily. Which I think absolutely translates into why I still do stand up, you know.
And I was going to say, I did notice when I was doing some research on you that it did mention the diving, and that between Southside High School and then Fairfield University being a D1 school for diving, you did set a diving record in college, did you not?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's still there. Gosh, it's been there since like 2002, maybe. And I don't think anybody's beaten it since then. I do like about once a year check to make sure nobody's beaten my record. Yeah, it's a 3 meter record for like a 6 dive meet. Anyway, yeah, it's something I really loved. And then I always was kind of funny. Like I did a little bit of improv in college, but it was very cliquish. Like even the director of the program was like, you're a swimmer, which people always got wrong. I'd be like, no, you're a swimmer. So you're not really serious about this. Like you have to be a theater major. And I was like, wow, that sucks. Then, while I was in college, I really thought I wanted to be a reporter. So I had an internship at Dateline at NBC. And then while I was like bored to tears working there, and I somehow figured out how to get myself a internship for Conan for the next year, my senior year. That's while Conan was still in New York before he moved to LA, before that whole like late night turf war with Jay Leno.
Right.
And, that internship is when I realized, okay, like, I'm not sure what I want to do in comedy, but these are my people. I feel more comfortable in this kind of thing. And, it was exciting, like, you know, seeing the guests, but mostly it was unglamorous. Like you're getting the writer's coffee, you're printing things out, you're ordering dinner for people.
Yeah.
But it was neat.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask because, again, I read your bio and I found it fascinating in a lot of respects. Between like your experiences in college, right? But even before that, some famous comic alumni from your high school, Amy Schumer, Dave Attell, Colin Kane. Were you aware of that while you were still in high school?
No, they were older than me. Like, well, Amy Schumer was in my sister's grade, so she was 2 years ahead of me. And all I knew about her was that she was like really into volleyball. Because nobody's really who they're going to be in high school. So I don't know if she was known for being funny in high school. I remember I was upset that I didn't get class clown. I got most spirited though. I was like, is that going to foretell a drinking problem? I do love the spirits. I can't get enough of them. But I remember, I think June Diane Raphael was also into my high school. And she ended up being like a producer, I think, on either Bridesmaids or some like comedy movie. So yeah, like quite a few kind of famous folks went through Southside. I think Howard Stern, he might have been from Roosevelt, like a few towns over.
Right, but I think
something about Long Island produces a lot of funny people. I think it's all the chemical testing they did during the 40s and gives everybody kids. It's like you're either going to get cancer or you're going to be hilarious or both.
Or both. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because it's funny how your environment sometimes shapes you. Like my high school was a nerd high school, right? So our famous graduates were all like Nobel Prize winners and scientists and everything. Yeah. So growing up, I felt odd in my high school because I was the one who was running around trying to crack a joke while, you know, doing somebody's karyotype at the same time. So I don't think it's necessarily how you influence the rest of your life necessarily, I think it does play into how you see the world. Like, so I grew up that it was easy for me to make people laugh because people around me were all serious nerds, right? So it didn't take much to get them to smile. But I'm assuming that if you're surrounded by clowns and cut-ups and screw-ups and whatever, the ability to make them laugh probably sharpens your comedic edges, right? And your tone and your sarcasm and all that. So maybe that, even if you weren't aware of it, maybe that had some effect on you, that everybody around you was a clown. So maybe you felt, hey, if I want to go one up.
Especially at Compound Media, that's where I feel like I got the most sharpened because, yeah, everyone's just – and Anthony Cumia is absolutely hilarious and all the like the comics that would come on his show and just – you kind of like – it was my natural style of bantering to begin with, but just being around all those funny people like really – sharpens you up for sure. So I'm so grateful to Anthony and Compound Media. That was the first place I ever had a podcast. Like that was my start there. And I started there in like 2018 and then pitched my own show 2019, The Wet Spot. And then that ran until the network was shut down just last summer, last June. Everybody got fired. No. Gavin came in and fired everybody unceremoniously. So yeah. We're all off on our own.
Compound Media is almost, I could talk to you for a whole hour just on Compound Media. It's really interesting because I was a big ONA fan. I was a big Ron and Fez fan. And it was actually Ron who helped me get my show on Sirius XM because I would call into his show every week, once a week, every Monday. So they got to know me as a call-in. And then eventually Ron reached out to me and said, hey, you know, I think you could do your own show. And I said, wow. I think so too, you know, because I had been doing podcasting before it was podcasting. Like in 95 or so, doing fantasy football and sports and things like that. But what was interesting about that was when Compound Media started and Anthony was building out his studio on 35th, I literally had an office across the street. I worked at an ad agency, and literally by that, it was adjacent to that coffee shop on the corner of 35th and 7th. And I said, oh, let me just walk into a studio and see if I can hang out there for a while. And Anthony, being the type of guy he is, I'd walk into the studio and I'd say, hey, I'm here to watch the show. Is it okay if I hang out? And he was like, yeah, sure, hang out. Just stay out of the way. Like, I've never seen anybody so casual and laid back about dealing with his fans. I think most people in his position would have been like, security, throw this idiot out, you know, or something like that. But that sense I got there was amazing. I wish I could just take every day off and just sit in the bleachers and just watch all the comedians, as you said, and the guests. And talk to me about Anthony a little bit, because he is a character, and I think at times he might be misinterpreted by a lot of the general media. Like, they always try to paint him as this ultra right wing, loathe to say, almost racist or a bigot. And in actuality, he's really not, is he?
No, he's really not. We were all kind of robbed in the middle of the studio one day. This is an example of how Compound Media is so not racist. There was this random black chick wandered into the studio one day, and it was during my show. And my show was after Gino Visconti's show in Hot Water. And it's his show, and then this little time, like, and then it's my show at 7 o'clock. But this girl is just hanging out. We figure if she's here to see a show or be on a show, and we were so not racist that we didn't question her. We didn't talk to her. My show goes on at 7. This woman steals $300 out of my purse, one of my other friends' debit cards, something else from someone, and then she just leaves because I didn't even notice till maybe the next day, the next morning when I like went to open my wallet, and I was like, it was the week I was like, let me be a person who carries cash on my person. Like, let me be a cash girl, and I'll pay for things in cash, and I'll that's who I'll be. And hell no, no more. And we ended up looking back on the security footage, and like, sure enough, we see this chick going through all the pockets in our coats, going through. I mean, I was stupid to leave my purse like out there under the table, but at the same time, the Compound Media, you know, studio and waiting room just felt like our home, so. The last thing we were expecting was for somebody to come in and steal our shit. You know, a lot of people didn't even really know where we were. So if you don't seem like, oh, this person's a hater, she's here to like heckle us, or this person's here to protest. Right. It didn't seem that way. So we just let this woman quietly steal hundreds of dollars from us. So like that actually says that we're not racist, and we didn't, but we should have been actually. We should have profiled her and kicked her out.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because your time at Compound, and it was also in combination with your Chrissy Mayer podcast, that I first became aware of you as an interviewer, as a comedian. And one of the interesting things I found, and one of the reasons I tried to reach out to you many, many years ago, was I kind of had the feeling that you were looking for a political identity to tie into your comedy, right? And at the time, I think I noticed you because you were exploring libertarianism. And I noticed you were interviewing a lot of libertarian guests, common friend of ours, Larry Sharp, for example.
Oh, I love Larry. Oh,
right, yeah.
Larry is responsible for my gold pilling, for sure. I was like a disaffected liberal Democrat many years ago. Like, it was 2018 when I was sort of like coming out of it, my brainwashing, and just a few conversations with Larry Sharp, and I was like, wow, I guess I am more libertarian in some ways.
Larry is one of those libertarians that makes you happy to be a libertarian. He's not overbearing, and he puts things in terms that everyone can understand, and he's always open to talk to folks, and I find that great about him, and really one of the good guys. New York is lucky to have him. I noticed that you probably took the path of most New Yorkers in your sort of political evolution, right? Like, most New Yorkers, especially those that grow up in Long Island, New York City, probably tend to be liberals or Democrats.
Yeah.
Then if they're successful at all, they're taxed to death. Then at some point, if they work in Manhattan, they get mugged or held up a couple of times. And their perception starts to change, right? They start to understand that maybe the nanny state isn't the answer. So at the time that I first noticed you were exploring libertarianism. If I were to look at you now, I'd say you're more into the MAGA camp. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but talk to me about that. As you said, starting out as a Jill Stein voter, then becoming a libertarian, or at least exploring libertarianism, and now maybe settling in at the Trump camp. I mean, he sent a message, I think, for your wedding, right? So
he was at my wedding.
Oh, he was at your wedding. So
we had a Trump impersonator.
Oh, okay.
At the wedding, it was iconic. It was really more so from my husband's side. My side of the family weirdly has no sense of humor, so
okay,
they didn't get it.
But talk to me a little bit about your sort of like your journey of. And by politically, I don't necessarily mean voting for candidates or potentially running for office, but how you perceive things from that perspective, because the way I see it, it could be one of two things. You're either evolving towards like either a libertarian or conservative position, or maybe you're there. Or the other possibility is that you're more contrarian in nature, like that maybe as a comedian, you look at things and say, okay, I'm not going to riff on what people agree on. I'm going to riff on the things that are objectionable to any given status quo, like anti-authoritarian or perhaps even contrarian. What do you think about that?
It depends on the subject matter. Yeah, I think it is, as a stand-up comedian, it is important to be kind of contrarian and like root for the unpopular take. Yeah, sometimes I will, like, especially on Twitter, like just try to mess with people or like maybe purposely trigger folks. But overall, I think as I get older, there definitely are certain aspects that are moving more conservative. For becoming a mom, for sure, I get it. So many things click into place when you become a parent. You're just like, oh, okay, you know, no wonder there's this such fervor and passion, like for the Moms for Liberty and all these other groups that have come to the aid of. Supposedly trans kids. It's a social contagion. It's a mass brainwashing movement. It's really part of this multi-prong sterilization effort. Right. Everything from, like, you know, not that we're going to talk about COVID, but maybe something related to that era. There's many forces going on to kind of keep people from, I think, reproducing and thriving in this world. And there's so much bullshit to sort through. But certainly on borders, you know, the migrant crisis the last few years has really pushed me more conservative on that front. Yeah, of course, anybody who, even, you know, my first lifeguarding job, you see how much taxes are taken out. Then I feel like you slowly over time become a little bit more conservative or less big government, at least. So yeah, it might be a, and for sure, like, my biggest issue is free speech. That's like my, that's the hill I'll always die on. I think that is that's probably what fuels a lot of my contrarian tweets and jokes is free speech and just how important it is to keep that going and almost like a muscle at the gym that you have to keep working. Even if you piss people off, you have to keep it moving.
Right. And free speech has always been one of the great issues that anybody with any sort of certainly comedic leanings would. I'm actually shocked, Chrissy, to be honest with you, at how many comedians will self-censor, not because they feel it's best for their act, but because they feel it's better for society for them to self-censor themselves. And I find that to be very confusing to me. And again, I'm not a stand-up comedian or anything.
Because it's bullshit, John. That's why it's not about society. It's about not losing jobs, not losing connections. It's like you'll see a lot of these mainstream comedians – They say, oh, like, I've been picking on her a lot recently, but only because this is a recent article. Like, there's an article that came out in March where Nikki Glaser is saying that she's afraid to do political material because she doesn't want to be thrown in a gulag or something. And you hear Kathy Griffin say a lot of bullshit like that. And it's just kind of trendy. It's a way for a certain type of mainstream comic to signal to – It's really about like the Hollywood club, I think, which is a shame but once you get to a certain level and you make a certain amount of money, you really don't want anything to endanger your bag. Like, I think Bill Burr is a really good example of that. He was a much edgier comic. You know, if you listened to O&A back in the day,
sure.
He was a much edgier comic. And now that he got the Star Wars money, he was on one of the seasons of Mandalorian, and he's just become more high level. He's kind of like Howard Stern in that he compromised. I don't know if you want to call him compromised or he just changed. Like, he'd rather hobnob with the elites and not piss anybody off and go on The View than make fun of the women who were on The View. So it's just sad to see, but on the other hand, like, I get it. If you make a lot of money and want to maintain your lifestyle, you don't owe it to anybody but yourself to, stay authentic, I guess. Like, if it's up to you and your own conscience, what bothers you? Is the money more important, or is your sense of humor, is free speech, is like truly connecting with an audience more important?
No, I agree with you. And one of the more disappointing things is, as you get older, because as you could tell from our hair colors, I'm vastly older than you are, is seeing your free speech idols, and I guess it's not so much that they're not as edgy or not as controversial anymore. That I'm perfectly aligned with. You get older, you're tired of fighting. As Patrice used to say, you go from being a foot soldier in the free speech war to being a general or something like that, so you're not going to be fighting every day. But it's more the turning on the other comedians who are still in the battle, who are still fighting. Patton Oswalt is known for this, right? And I'm more upset at guys like Stern. You mentioned Bill Burr. Amy Schumer is another one who, you know, if you were an O&A fan, you might have said Amy is one of the first funny women, right? Because you always had that running gag on O&A about women not being funny. And, you know, when she showed up with Patrice and all these other guys, you were like, hey, she's hanging with the men.
Yeah,
she's got a certain edge to her.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And then all of a sudden, like you said, she made Trainwreck, her movie, which I found funny. But after that, she seemed to change. And at one point, she actually said she was playing a character she, you know, initially. And I found that to be very disappointing. And like all the people who turned on Daniel Tosh for making a rape joke, or and the ones that have stayed true to their beliefs, Anthony being one of them, who paid a price for speaking his truth, right? You lost a multi-million dollar gig at Sirius because of it. You look at Jim Norton, who I think has remained relatively constant in his comedy, and those people to me are the ones I admire. I'm not even saying I would do the same thing. I'm a coward for the most part. So if I had to protect my millions, Chrissy, I'm not sure that I wouldn't necessarily change my act. But I think I would have enough integrity to not crap on other people who are still fighting that fight. So I agree with you. That 1A, I think, is very huge, and that's probably the biggest part of what drew me to libertarianism, that and the economic issues when I was younger. So back in the 80s, I would consider myself a Buckley conservative, but I would always say the one thing I disagree with conservatives on is how much they would try to clamp on free speech, whether it was anti-pornography or anti-comedy or whatever. I always felt that that was their main – that's what they got wrong on this issue in their political philosophy.
What's a Buckley conservative?
So William F. Buckley, who was the editor of the National Review, had the opportunity to meet him and correspond with him. And he was what today we would call the precursor to Ronald Reagan and his brand of conservatism. So William F. Buckley was a writer. A great fiction writer, used to write spy novels all the time. He used to be in the CIA. He may or may not have been involved in assassination attempts on Fidel Castro at one point, I think, but nobody knows for sure. But he was super conservative. I would say he was somewhere between a neocon and a libertarian, if you had to sort of put it that way in a very broad stroke. But the free speech issue is what got me in the 80s, and I started to say, you know, I don't know that I believe in this anymore, in being a neocon, and that's what eventually led me to becoming a libertarian and really following not so much Ron Paul, but Milton Friedman, for me, was my libertarian dude. Okay, great.
Cool.
So do you consider yourself to still be on sort of like your journey of trying to sort out your identity in terms of how you fit in politically into the world or how you want to shape your commentary going forward, or is it more, I'm just attacking what I see to be a problem that's in front of me?
I think, well, it's so easy to focus on, at this point, racial issues and the trans thing. That to me seems like the easiest topics to make fun of right now, because it's just it's easy to trigger people and like play with people on that. So like it's just so easy. Like I took a picture of the cockpit of the plane when I was flying to Indiana to do a gig, and there was a black guy in the co-pilot seat, and I took a picture and tweeted it and said, if I don't make it to Indiana, blame DEI. That was, John, I'm not joking, like, that was 6 weeks ago, 6 or 7 right. weeks ago. I still have people in my comments shitting on me for that, like, just so, so offended. It went so kind of viral that even the they found out who the pilot was, and he ended up like responding to it. And
really?
It was ridiculous. I was like, I can't believe you guys take this seriously. But I'm like, you're acting like I invented DEI. I did not invent right. DEI. If everybody is so qualified and it's just merit, why do we need to invent DEI? Why did it need to exist? And I'm like, you guys did this to yourselves, you know? And then go for the Democratic Party who glamorized this and popularized this and make it seem like black people can't do anything and get anywhere without DEI, without white people helping them out. So it's like, you created this mess for yourselves. But, but you're going to get mad at me for a joke instead of the people you keep voting for? Okay.
Yeah, I've always felt that if you're a liberal and you can't, A, accept that it's a joke, or B, articulate why the joke is flawed, because I'll even give them that. If they'll say, Chrissy Mayer, you're wrong because, and here's a list of reasons why they think you're wrong, I'm willing to accept that. But the like, Chrissy Mayer, shut up because you shouldn't be talking about DEI and you shouldn't be making fun of DEI, that clearly is something where I'm just as apt as you are to throw up a middle finger and just like troll them even harder, right?
There were so many comments like, oh, don't you know that like women are in DEI too? I'm like, yes. And I also make fun of women who get positions they don't deserve. Like if that was a woman in the cockpit, I would be just as nervous.
My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's interesting because from my own experience in the corporate world, which I know is an anathema to most comedians and entertainers, but I remember about 15 years ago, they called us into a meeting because, you know, like you had to be a vice president or above one of those meetings. And one of the two major banks in the U.S., and there was this announcement that there was an effort to make sure that women got paid the same as men for the same work, you know, blah, blah, blah. Women earn 23% less.
Okay, well, yeah, then don't ever take maternity leave. Don't ever, like...
Well, that was the thing. But being a data scientist, I was like, well, actually, I'm going to take it upon myself to show them that they're wrong. So I put together all the data we had and everything and proved to them that women typically only make up a 3% difference in pay for men. And that typically can be explained by taking time off to have a baby or you know, to take care of home matters in traditional roles, right? And literally, I think something like three women that I worked with on a daily basis then said, I refuse to work with a misogynist. And they made it a point of, like, not working with me, which I couldn't care less, right? Yeah. But the point being that the facts and the data that they themselves were trying to cite inappropriately, which was disappointing because they themselves were data scientists, but it just goes to show you that contagion that you were saying, that social contagion, is really in effect. And
They shouldn't even have that job. They sound like they're letting their personal opinions skew their work. You're coming at them with statistics that are emotionless, that have no ulterior motive, and then they call you a misogynist.
Right. Ultimate nerd stuff, but they could be misogynists. But having said that, let me ask you another question, because I also tend to see now a bit of the reverse. So the pendulum was on the side where you couldn't say anything without being attacked. We have the cases of people being canceled over speech, Anthony Cumia being a prime example. What I'm noticing now, though, is that perhaps, and I want to get your take on this, is the pendulum swung to the other way, where there's folks who are knowingly providing misinformation. And when I say misinformation, I don't mean in the COVID sense. I just mean in general. Knowingly lying, knowingly misrepresenting themselves and the facts, and then using free speech as a shield to protect themselves ideologically, say, from any blowback. Do you feel that the pendulum may have swung to the other end where I can be an a-hole, and if someone calls me out on it, I'll just say, hey, man, free speech?
There's always going to be people, no matter what's going on, that are like that. There's always going to be people that justify bad behavior and rudeness with free speech, whether it's today or it's, an administration in the past, you know. And I feel like we're always one administration away from potentially having some rights being taken from us. So it's important to, like, kind of always stay vigilant and not take your foot off the gas. When you say that there are people that will, cite misinformation, like, what kinds of people are you talking about specifically? Do you mean journalists? Do you mean?
I mean anyone, because I like, if you're involved, say, in LP politics, right? One of the movements that I've seen recently is the so-called libertarian right, where they'll misquote Hoppe or they'll misapply Hoppe because he has sort of a hard line on property rights and what's allowable under property rights. And they'll cite anthropological studies to justify racism, where you'll see some of these free staters like, hey, every time we see someone that doesn't look like us, we should harass them until they leave our state. And it's okay to spit at them and yell at them and chase them down. You know, anything short of physical, and in some cases, some of them have advocated for physical involvement. And I'm just like, if you call them out on it, they'll say, whoa, I thought you were a libertarian. Why are you infringing on my free speech? Mm. And my position is, it's okay. I'm not telling you you're not allowed to say it or you can't go to jail, that you should go to jail for saying it. I'm just saying you're an asshole, and I think people should know you're an asshole, in my opinion. So that's what I refer to by misinformation or misuse of facts. And again, I'm not trying to say there's an official story, like there's an official COVID story or an official Ukraine war story or whatever. But yeah, whether it's journalists, comedians, entertainers, politicians, do you feel that?
It sounds like what you're saying, like there will always be people who selectively take, you know, they'll cite a great thinker or a leader or even statistics, like the example you mentioned before, they will selectively take something to suit their arguments. And that will always be going on. There will always be people doing that. So it's important. Like, I think the best place to hash out something like that is on Twitter, where you can argue with somebody and really, like, bring your receipts and debate someone if that's what you enjoy, or prove somebody right or wrong. But has it been caused by a pendulum swinging? I don't think so. If anything, like, there's a sense of, okay, Trump's in office. People can kind of exhale. Like, Elon bought Twitter. Okay, things are not perfect, but they're better, you know, in the town's public square, so to speak. So, like, yeah, people are still getting banned, but it is, it's overall just better. And I think it's interesting. I just feel like it's going to be interesting to see, like, what happens, because I feel like the Trump administration, like, is kind of pedaling hard like a duck. Like, you can't really see the legs paddling under the surface of the water. And I feel like the deep state is doing that, too. I just get the sense, like, I'm hopeful that the Trump administration is really going to, like unearth some deep roots there. I feel like they are giving it the best effort that anyone has in the past. So I know that's not answering your question at all. But
no, that's okay. One question can lead to another. That's all right. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this then. When I was doing a little bit of a deeper research on you, in a lot of corners, what would pop up is Chrissy Mayer is a conspiracy theorist. Chrissy Mayer was at January 6th. Chrissy Mayer seems to agree a lot with Roger Stone, and he's full of crap. How would you address that? If someone says, hey, Chrissy Mayer, you're a QAnon person, you're a conspiracy theorist, you fall for this nonsense, how would you address that?
And I would say, well, what specifically in QAnon do you think I agree with? Like, anyone who comes at me with insults like that, I just, you ask, and anyone can do this, like, just ask them to be specific. Be like, what specifically? Oh, well, I read this. Well, you can read a lot of things about a person, because all it takes is one person with a motive who wants to make you look bad, who can publish an article. They can say right. Literally anything. And I know of a few examples. It just took one person saying that I'm into QAnon in one article for that to now be part of my Wikipedia or whatever comes up when you search me. So, right. I would just like, well, I'd be like, what do you mean by that? Oh, it was just someone with an article who wrote. And that's the thing. When you are a Trump voter, it's easy for people to attach all these other titles to you because they hate Trump voters even still, even though it's like more than half the country now. Conspiracy theory wise, like, if you want to break that down, is it a conspiracy that there's like child trafficking going on in our country, and that's an extremely profitable business, that there's human trafficking, that there's sex trafficking going on? I think it's fun to kind of like poke holes in things that we think that we know for sure. Like, okay, let's say, and I always have fun with the flat earthers. Like, what if the earth was flat? Like, we still all have to get up and go to work tomorrow. How does that actually like change most of our lives? It doesn't. It's just kind of fun to think about. And I think it's fun to like kind of make jokes about it, but like conspiracy wise, I mean, maybe that was a label that got, it's so funny because so many things have just come true at this point. Anybody who's followed Alex Jones for the last 10 years, how many of his conspiracy theories have now come true? So I would just say, like, anybody who has a reputation of being a conspiracy theorist is just somebody who thinks outside the box and just doesn't, likes to dig a little bit deeper into everything they see.
So on that vein, since you mentioned it, you're saying, like, when I go to Grok and say, tell me about Chrissy Mayer, it says people think she's a conspiracy theorist and believes in QAnon and things like that. You're saying, no, you're not a QAnon person, or by conspiracy theories, like, you're not a flat earther, right? Or, like, do you think we went to the moon, or do you think that's a government conspiracy?
I think it's possible we didn't go to the moon. I think it's interesting to think because, right, didn't what's-his-face Kubrick make the footage he created was really just Stanley Kubrick creating, like, a fake moon landing?
A lot of people, some people say that, yeah.
It's fun to think about. It's fun to think about, like, okay, if that was true, what else is true? And then where does that lead us?
Right. No, look, to your point, there are things that were formerly labeled conspiracy theories that actually have then been proven to have been true, like the medical experimentation on African Americans in this country, as late as
Tuskegee,
Tuskegee and other things that people are MK Ultra or something like that. You know, yes, conspiracy theories that ended up. But I don't know if it's just me, but in the conspiracy theories where I see a tangible benefit to someone, I'm more willing to accept those. The ones where I can't in any way fathom someone benefiting from, those I find harder to swallow. Like Flat Earth is the perfect one. Okay, you're not claiming that somebody's math is wrong. You're claiming that people are purposely hiding the fact that the Earth is flat. And I'm sitting there going, okay, let's assume, to your point, let's assume it is flat. Who's benefiting from the fact that they're fooling us into thinking it's round, right?
And so many people have to be in on it, like generations.
Right. Well, I honestly, I feel the same way about the moon landing. And it's one of those things where, you know, if you ask Elon Musk, who tends to feed into some of these, you'd be like, okay, so are you going to Mars? Is your planning to going to Mars to make us interplanetary? Is that a conspiracy theory since we never went to the moon? Or is it something that could have evolved over time? And I'm willing to believe pieces of it, Chrissy, to be honest with you, like we were in the Cold War, so you're not going to show actual footage of stuff. So Kubrick made up footage, but we actually did go to the moon. I see that to me is more plausible than saying we never went to the moon, to me personally. You know, there's people who lost their lives on launch pads, right, and in test flights in that pursuit of going to the moon. So to me, it doesn't hold too much water. But like you said, I don't mind people questioning it. It's just the people who then refuse to acknowledge math or, you know, like like the flat earthers, everything they bring up is easily disproven by math, right? Whether it's their stupid, like, you know, curvature angles and earth rotations. There's
have
an
you
MMA
ever, fighter. You should interview David Weiss. I had him on my channel. He's a flat earther, and he had very convincing arguments, none of which I remember right now, but I remember listening to him going, okay, like he's explaining himself well. And I also think if we had gone to the moon and we still had the capability to go to the moon, or people say, oh, we lost the capability to go to the moon, I just find that so hard to believe.
No, that part's wrong. We do have the capability to go to the moon.
Why are there not influencers on the moon? Like, why are the Kardashians not on the moon? Okay, if they've been everywhere else. Like, why do we not have TikToks going on the moon? It just, that's what makes it hard for me to believe, because we have the money. We have, like, even in, like, this Blue Origin bullshit, like, we have people who are millionaires who are like, yes, let me give me a ride on a little thing that goes up for 11 minutes and I'll come back down and call myself an astronaut. Like, okay, so we don't, why don't we have that for the moon then?
I think we will. I think that, and I mean, I know you're trying to make light of it, but I think that there will be commercial flights to the moon possibly before I kick off, certainly in your lifetime. Because up until recently, this was a military exercise. Like, going to the moon was a military exercise, no matter what country you were in, whether it was China, U.S., Canada, England, whatever. It was a military exercise. So, you know, don't forget, as late as, what, 1980 maybe? Or certainly during Star Wars, right, during the Reagan years in the mid-80s, owning space meant owning the high ground for a nuclear war or for any conventional war. So it was still considered a military exercise. I think now that it's not, and it's opened up to billionaires like Bezos and Musk, I think we will have commercial flights to the moon very soon. And I do believe Elon. See, as much as I question whether he should have entered politics for a lot of different reasons, I still view him as a visionary. And I think he is determined to get us to Mars. And I think he will, in his lifetime, get something to Mars, whether it's a manned expedition or at least setting up stuff on Mars for people to use. I think that's definitely, I don't think that's crazy at all. But who knows? Maybe in 10 years, around the time you have grandkids, maybe 20 years, you'll be taking a ride with them to the moon just for kicks on the weekend.
I don't know. There's so many places I haven't been yet. The moon would be, like, last on the list. Actually, I would probably go to the moon before, like, India or like, yeah. Any of those filthy countries, so.
And before you could potentially make your way through the South Bronx, you'd probably be
right, to the moon first. Right, right. I'd go to the moon before the South Bronx.
And I say that as a Bronx kid, by the way. So, okay. So we've talked about this and that. In terms of your comedy, what's there left on your list of things to accomplish? I mean, you're an accomplished stand-up comedian. Is acting on the table for you, or do you see yourself like getting a TV show? Like, where do you see yourself as the next step?
I'm open to whatever, like whatever is on the path. I think if I can, for stand-up, if I can merge my current life experience with what I do on stage, you know, you always want to make sure, like, I have this feeling like I have to constantly be like updating my OS, like updating my, my stage material to reflect exactly what's going on. Like, I don't really have very many jokes about my dad being murdered, and that was like a year and a half ago. And like, you know, I want to write more jokes about being a mom, even though that's, you know, I've been a mom for a year. So it's just thinking like, okay, like moving into this like new phase of my life and like what that material shift is going to look like. And of course, it's always easy to make fun of news and politics and cultural stuff. But yeah, some of these last like big life changes, thinking about how I'm going to incorporate that into my act, you know. Like share your like a personal side, maybe get into more like more dark jokes, but just keep it like really let the audience kind of like get to know you in a sense. I would like to do that, like get a little bit deeper with my material.
Right, that's your stand up evolution. Do you see yourself getting into areas outside of stand up?
I mean, I'm down for like whatever projects come my way if I have time and it sounds interesting. Like I would never limit myself. It's funny because like after I did a bunch of improv after college, and then I thought I wanted to be an actor, so I did a bunch of commercial auditions, and it was like rejection after rejection. It was just like the most steady stream of rejections, like just God telling me like, stop trying to be in herpes commercials, like stop auditioning for these random commercials, like just turn around and do something else. But like, yeah, of course I'm down for whatever sounds interesting for sure. Like I work on all types of interesting projects. So it's just having the like, I'm just exhausted all the time. I don't know if that's when that's going to go away. In terms of being a mom, it never goes away. You're always tired.
Trust me. It never goes away. Trust me. I'm 60.
Just falling asleep in the middle of the day. That's new for me.
Oh, I'll be honest with you, Chrissy. I've told people this. I've been chasing the entrepreneurial dream while still trying to support a family, right? So basically, and this is no exaggeration, starting from my days on Wall Street to now, I've never slept more than 4 hours a day.
Whoa.
I'm not exaggerating by that. I'm one of the few people on the planet, I think, that can still be alive at my age.
Is that an alarm, or you just naturally wake up?
I fall asleep around 4 in the morning every day, and I wake up around 8:30, 9 o'clock to get my kid off to his program. Yeah, so it's like, yeah, that's been my life for the last...
What are you up doing till 4 in the morning?
Oh, editing shows like this and reaching out to guests and writing some material for other shows that we produce here at Grumblings Media. And it's just that I've had trouble with my brain shutting off. If I have nothing to do and I'm still awake, I'll catch up on some stand-up specials that I haven't seen yet. I'll think about a project. I'm always thinking about a project I could do, whether it's building a new app or starting a new company or something like that. It's always something. And I don't know if it's a curse or a blessing or a little bit of both, but
you can't turn it off. Yeah. You're always working on something.
Can't turn it off. Can't turn it off at all. Quick question though. You did mention improv and stand up. And I think for people who just view comedy as something that makes them laugh, they may not be aware of the difference between improv and stand up. Tell us a little bit about the distinction between the two genres of comedy, because and I'll be honest with you, I've never found improv to be all that great, but I love stand-up. So talk to me about why my bias may exist.
Improv, because there's more bad improv, I think, than there is bad stand-up. Improv is really more, I would consider to be like theater games, and like theater people tend to do improv. It's you're learning how to trust your scene partner and like build and create a scene with that other person, where stand up is like completely autonomous. You rehearse jokes in advance. It can be all written out. It can be 0% improvisation. Whereas like my stand up is like at least 40% improv. It's an amazing exercise to do, because you can't pre-plan anything. You have to just trust your scene partner and literally start like on ground zero with them, and creating everything from where you are to what kind of characters you are, what you're doing, and then like build a scene and like accomplish tasks from there. And you have to be it taught me to be a really good listener. It taught me to kind of like let go a bit, and it opens you up creatively. Like, you'll do exercises where you have to like personify, like, if your toaster could talk, what would he sound like? Oh, well, I've got tons of crumbs on the bottom and no one's cleaned me out in a year and a half, you know? Or if like your ice machine could talk, like, what would it say? And like those goofy exercises they're fun, and like you would never do them anywhere else. And it helps you like play, and it helps to restore kind of like childlike play in adults. So in the improv class, it's yes, like former theater kids, but also people at regular day jobs that are looking to increase their public speaking skills, or maybe like dudes trying to meet girls, or like some stand-up comics. So it's like it's a good mix. It's a nice complement to your life. But there are some people who just, they take class after class after class, and it's like you're going to go into debt just, you know, ponying up another $500 every 6 to 8 weeks or so. But I did that for a good 5 years, and then did a one woman show. And then I started stand up. Because like when I started, I really thought, oh God, am I going to be plucked out for SNL? Like all these other people that go to the UCB theater. And then yeah, I did all the commercial auditions, and then I just was like, no, it'd be cool to like a good challenge. A good next step would be like to do that one woman show. So I just wrote, a bunch of different characters based on like people in my life. Like this girl I went to college with was a character. This woman that cuts my hair was a character. And it was about like this woman who gets pregnant, or this teenage girl, I don't know how old, maybe young 20s, gets pregnant, and she's trying to figure out if she should keep it or not, which is like funny, 'cause it's like, I've never even had an abortion scare. Like thank God. Right. 'Cause in my younger, like feminist brainwashed years, like I could have made a horrible decision, but thank God I've never been in that position. So
this was your show, Hope, by the way? Hope?
Yeah, the show is called Hope. It was like, I think it was like an hour long or something. It was like a real, that's like a big step from just doing like improv scenes that are just a few minutes long. And that show ran on and off for about 6 weeks at the Magna Theater. It was like kind of a big deal. And then I was like, well, okay, I've been on stage all this time by myself. I think I can do stand up. I started doing that in like 2010, 2011, I guess. And my God, now it's 2025 and I haven't stopped.
Well, good for you. And I know all of us are happy about that. But one thing I have to ask you that I would be remiss if I did not ask you. You're responsible, perhaps, for creating something known as the Dabbleverse. Certainly, you granted it its name. Mm-hmm. For those of us that may not know, tell me what the Dabbleverse is, how you became involved in it. I think I know the story, but I'd rather listen to you tell it.
Okay, so for my interview, I had an interview that I, you know, interview show that I started in January of 2020, and then May of 2020 pandemic, I was like, let me do multiple times a week, right? Let me do a different podcast than most stand-up comics who just interview other stand-up comics, and it becomes very insular and like is not something that appeals to like the vast majority of people. So, right, I'm doing an interview podcast, and that's what's the Chrissy Mayer podcast. And I was like, okay, I'm going to interview Stuttering John. And I had spoken to my friend Gino Bisconti, who was a fellow Compound Media talent. And he was like, well, I don't know. He told me he kind of doesn't really do comedy. He sort of does it. He's like not real serious about it. So remembering that during my interview, I was like, oh, John, I've heard that you sort of like dabble in stand up. And he absolutely flipped his lid. He couldn't handle the fact that he was, you know, called that he dabbled in stand-up. And I was like, I don't know, dude. I just fucking haven't seen your name on any billboards. I haven't seen your name on any lineups of clubs that I've been to. I'm not claiming to be a household name, but I sure, you know what I mean? You go to a club and you see who's coming up or who's come before you, and I just have never seen. So I'm like, and it's not that, I didn't think it was a big freaking deal. And he just, and also it was kind of at that moment or a little bit before that his camera froze and I was too afraid to tell him to reset it. So his face is frozen this whole time. He could not get over the fact that I said that he dabbled in comedy. He said, no, I'm so, I do stand up for 25 years. I'm famous. I'm a big deal. Cause this whole thing, you know, if you talk to Stuttering John about like the glory days, like Howard Stern, it's like, then it's a great interview. But if you ask him like what he's doing now, then he gets surly. So I should have just kept it on the glory days, I suppose. and then the interview goes on and on. And then he goes, well, you do stand up, right, Chrissy? Don't you? And I go, yeah, I dabble. And it was like the perfect little button on the end of the interview. Cause I'm like, this dude takes himself way too seriously. I think it's just everybody's job to have a thicker skin. Cause you're only as strong as your triggers. And then the Dabbleverse was created, which ended up being a whole bunch of people who liked to watch Stuttering John's content and videos, right, and critique them, and like the guests he would have on, like he just his green screen backdrop falling down, and just like poke fun at him, and then it just sort of this community came about with a, I don't know if there was like a Reddit page or. Yeah, there was a Reddit page. It's a Reddit page, and now there's other people in the Dabbleverse, like Opie. Opie has found himself in the Dabbleverse. He's and any sort of like lol cow ends up there in the sort of comedy world, I suppose. You know, if you're a sad kind of like small time person, comedian, or like, and that's the thing, if you, and then there's a bunch of podcasts, they just talk about each other, and it's which is like fine if that's what you want to do for your content. But I think it's more so focused around these lol cows like Stuttering John and Opie, who just no matter what they do, keep stepping in it and are fun to make fun of. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah. I was going to say, I marvel at the actual market. See, to me, it's a great lesson in free markets and filling a need, whether you knew it was there or not. And how could anyone have predicted this? Only the markets could have predicted this. It's like this whole new universe that's been created around just crapping on Stuttering John, Opie, and similar folks, whether it's
convention, we had DabbleCon. We had like a whole, it was like, well, a meet and greet. It was so cool.
I give credit to guys like Carl from WATP, or even Shuli from the Shuli Network, and yourself to some extent. And for a while, if you had asked me, I would have said this is some professional wrestling storyline or work, that there is no way that Opie and Stuttering John and Aaron Imhol and all these guys aren't in on the fact that they provide content to be goofed on in order for them to get a kickback. Like I was convinced that it's some sort of intricate pro wrestling work, because I refuse to believe that someone like Opie, for example, who was one of the biggest broadcasters on radio for an extended period of time, can't fathom what's going on. Like, if he doesn't want people to goof on him, stop podcasting or change your podcast. And if you are aware of it, being the type of guy that you were, former quote-unquote shock jock, Anthony Cumia's partner, for those that don't know, why not lean into it? Why not use it to get your next gig? Sort of like what Anthony's done, right? Like, he's parlayed, for those that don't know, into an AM show on WABC in New York, where he's more of a political commentator now, as well as just the general pop culture guy commenting on that. So I always found it funny, and so I don't know if you feel that way, or if you feel that like these guys that are the targets in the Dabbleverse really are not self-aware enough to understand that they are literally providing food for 5-6 of these podcasters to put food on the table for them.
It is a real lack of self-awareness, and I think when it comes to Opie, I've been trying to learn more and more about him. I invited him on my show. He said I was boring. And I was like, well, this means I need to cover Opie more. And it's a combination of, I think, fear and laziness. Like he is afraid. I don't know if he's afraid of success or afraid of failure. He in his mind thinks if he really tries to do a podcast, he will be compared to Anthony Cumia. But it's like, dude, no matter what you do, you're going to, first of all, it's no comparison. Anthony's blown you out of the water several times right. over. So that's not even, put that out of your mind. It's not going to even close, buddy. Even if he were to get a very professional thing together, it'd be like, what the hell took you so long? What were you waiting for? So he's just kind of afraid to do that. Maybe he doesn't want to be, but it's like you came up together. You're both famous because of the other one. So to think that you're never not going to be associated. Sorry, Opie. Like that's just like any other duo, like
Abbott and Costello or whatever.
Yes, Siegfried and Freud, the gay tiger trainers, the the film critics, like Tom and Jerry. You know.
Yes. Laurel and Hardy to show my age.
Right, the ambiguously gay duo, all of them. You just do what you want to do. Don't not do something because of Anthony Cumia. And it's just sad that he has a shitty, like he'll live stream for like 45 minutes, an hour, 6:30 in the morning, very half-assed. We can always see the ring light and the reflection of his of his window, and he'll be like, oh, I'm doing great, look at this view, I'm crushing it. And it's like, dude, your face tells a different story.
Do you think he's trying to be like my one run-in with Opie when I was still at Sirius was one day I'm you know, because we had a weekend show, and one night Sam said, hey, Opie might be coming by tonight. You still up for meeting him? And I was a huge ONA fan. I had already met Jim and Anthony, and Opie was somebody I'd never had a chance to say hi to. I said, absolutely. So the whole night, I'm actually hanging out with his wife, who was pushing their kid around in a stroller at the time. And the whole time, there's this shadowy figure in the background with a hoodie and, you know, hanging out by the Shade 45 studio. And I'm like, it must be one of those hangers-on. I find out later that it was Opie the whole time. And that Sam and E-Rock had said to him, like, hey, that's Big John over there. He's dying to meet you, you know. And the big joke for him was that he was hiding in plain sight the whole time. So after they let me in on that the next week, I was like, oh, well, that was funny, I guess, you know, because now, like, he's left me hanging. And I said, maybe he's got a dark sense of humor, you know, like really dark sense of humor, and that he's doing it to laugh for himself. He doesn't care if anybody else laughs. So when I see that podcast, again, I'm like, there's no way he can be this unaware that what he's doing is absolutely putrid. And I don't mean that to crap on him. I just mean it is what it is with that show. Why wake up at 6 in the morning? Why, it's not morning radio. It's not drive time radio. Right. Why are you doing a podcast at 6 in the morning? But you're saying
that's what he's used to. That's his comfort zone. And also, I think the reason why he didn't come over and meet you, John, is because he's an elitist. Like he only concerns himself with people who can raise his profile or give him something. He doesn't like the fans. He puts himself above everybody. You know, unless you're like Howard Stern level or Joe Rogan. Ooh, remember he's like, Joe Rogan, put me on your podcast. He's a social climber. He doesn't care about people. That's why he has no friends. He hasn't maintained very many relationships from the Opie and Anthony days. How many comedians is he really friends with? He just puts himself above everybody.
It's interesting because you tell me, right? Like, I assume that when people achieve a brotherhood, like in the sense that, hey, we're in the same discipline or whatever. Like, I'm sure you can meet a stand-up that could be someone that you don't think is funny, but you'll accept them because to some degree because they're a stand-up, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a shared experience there, a shared, perhaps, suffering or whatever you want to call it. I assume that because, hey, I'm here in my studio, I'm doing my show, I'm coming out during commercial time saying hi to his wife and his whatever, you would think that if he was hanging out at that point, unless he was trying to pull a prank, that he would have said, hey, I'm Opie, man, good to see you or whatever, just on the recognition that we're both radio hosts at the same company. But that never happened, and I just assumed that it was initially. I assumed it was just because he thought it would be hilarious if I missed my chance to say hi to him. But
I think anyway. It's because he thinks he's better than everybody, and unless you're way more famous or can help him, he just doesn't have time for you. That's my impression of him.
Okay, I'll take your word for it because I don't know other than that one near hit experience. I've never actually met with him. Okay, Chrissy, thank you so much for your time so far today. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But before we end, I have a section that I always call silly questions. And these are just five questions with absolutely no rhyme or reason, just to get give folks a better understanding of perhaps your personality. So let's start out with the first one. In the last 2 years, you've gotten married and had a baby. How many minutes of new material has this added to your set?
Oh, my God. Wow. I would say at least 20. Maybe 30.
Oh, so you've got him. See, I remember guys like Bob Saget saying, all stand-up should have a kid. It adds 12 minutes to your set.
It does. It's true.
All right. So you got about 20 minutes, you think, out of it. That's fantastic. What would you say is the most embarrassing moment from a gig that you've had? When I had Jackie Martling here, he said, there's nothing that stand-ups love more than watching other stand-ups eat it on stage.
Aww.
Do you have any stories like that?
Yes, I was doing a gig in Syracuse, and I was like the Syracuse funny bone, and my aunt and uncle, who live up by Binghamton, came to hang out. And then, like, when my dad was still alive, he surprised me and came to that gig and showed up with them, and I absolutely bombed because I just was I wasn't happy to see him there. Like, I was very anxious. It's like, we didn't have a great relationship at the time. And, like, it just was so, so not good. It was just so uncomfortable. And you're on, like, a legit stage, like a funny bone comedy club. And you're just like, oh, my God. Every 5 minutes that goes by is like a snail's pace. And that was one of the worst times ever, for sure.
Do you remember getting grief from your fellow comics?
No, because I don't remember who. I hadn't brought like a host or a feature with me that time. It was just whoever the local people were. But I knew, like, if I come off stage going, that wasn't fun, then I know that I didn't do well.
Okay. You know, I remember Patrice telling the story of being at Boston one night and Kevin Hart was starting out. And he had bombed so hard that in the middle of his set, Patrice threw a phone book on stage and yelled out, read that, stupid. It's funnier than your entire set.
Oh, that's great.
And you can imagine, like, I think I would have melted if I was Kevin Hart at that point. But
that's great.
There you go. Okay. What's your favorite comfort food after a tough night?
Oh, well, right now it's air because I'm trying to lose that baby weight. But if I were in an eating mode, oh, my God, donuts are great. Like, especially from, like, the Stewart's rest stop. There's, like, some in upstate New York. I also really like anything with coconut. Anything like, oh, you know what's good? I like the sorbets that come in the coconut shell. Mm. Yeah, like, oh my God, coffee ice cream is great. What other snacks do I like?
It's a sweet tooth. Basically,
yeah,
something
for
sweet.
Sure. Oh, for okay. Sure. Yeah.
Excellent. In some mythical world, you're setting up a roast battle. What two people, alive or dead, would you put in that roast battle?
Oh, wow. Tony Hinchcliffe is one of the greats. So is Nikki Glaser. I guess I would pick them, too. But, oh, God, Patrice O'Neill is so good, too. Wow. God, you know what? Living or dead, that really does open it up quite a bit. I would say Patrice O'Neill and Joan Rivers.
Wow, that's an interesting pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Patrice, I think we could figure out why. Why Joan Rivers?
Because she's just an icon. I've always loved her style, and I don't know. I just love it. I love an old lady. I miss her on Fashion Police, for sure.
And she did have a mean streak to her comedy, to her stand-up. Like, if you watch some of her, not the stuff that was on The Tonight Show or her Fox show, but, I mean, if you watch some old stand-up of her, she could be really She's really so cutting funny. When she wanted to. Yeah, and Patrice, of course, probably my favorite comedian that I got to see live. Great. Okay. Best advice another comedian gave you and that you still use?
God, I don't have I gotten much advice from other comedians? Maybe not. I would say just to like have fun, but okay. That's kind of boring.
You can cite your own ego, your own id, if that's given you the best advice.
Yeah, being present and having fun.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, remembering that the crowd like wants to like you. They already like you. You just have to like get them there, you know.
Excellent. Okay, last one. Who would you put on your Mount Rushmore of comedy?
Ooh. Okay. My Mount Rushmore is going to be like, this is so random, but just because of like people I really enjoy, like from a, everyone's going to have a problem with this. Okay. Joan Rivers for sure. And just because I enjoy their physical comedy so much. Michael Richards, Jim Brewer, Norm MacDonald, Mark Normand.
One more. Okay, so you got
because everybody's going to pick Chris Rock, Chappelle, Colin Quinn, George Carlin. Like, everybody says those guys, so.
Yeah, no, that's a great top five. And it, from what I've seen, it's a mix of sarcasm and joke writing on your Mount Rushmore. In your stand-up, do you value the art of writing a joke, or do you really lean on the experiential and the storytelling aspect of it?
I would say lately probably more the storytelling aspect of it. Yeah. Okay. Because there's just like the life changes that have been going on with me the last few years. It's more like I'm just trying to like find my way through it. Yeah.
Well, you know, that sounds fantastic. Everyone, it's been Chrissy Mayer today on the Big Questions with Big John. I've certainly had a great time listening and talking with Chrissy. Chrissy, please let everyone know about your podcast, any upcoming gigs or specials you have coming up.
You can find me on Twitter at Chrissy Mayer, on Instagram, Chrissy Mayer Pod. My website is chrissymayer.com, where you can get tickets to upcoming shows. I'll be at Jazz on Main in Mount Kisco, which is in Westchester, on May 17th. And then I have more gigs coming up in Ohio, Texas, Long Island, Phoenix, San Diego. So stay tuned for those links. Thanks, John.
Okay. And everyone, we'll have all that information up as well to make sure you have it. Until next time, when we're here with someone almost as interesting as Chrissy Mayer.
Almost.
This has been Big John here at Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com.
Bye. Thank you.